You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, do giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Food with Mark Bittman, Big Picture Science, and Fork in the Road. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. You can enjoy extended commercial-free versions of this show by joining us at patreon.com/monstertalk, all one word, M-O-N-S-T-E-R-T-A-L-K. For as little as $2 a month, you can enjoy longer interviews, unbleeped language, and bonus episodes exclusive for patrons. And if $2 a month is not workable for you, but you still want to help out, be sure and leave us a positive review on your podcasting platform of choice. iTunes reviews in particular can help bring in new listeners, and your positive reviews really make a difference. If you want to learn other ways to help out, visit monstertalk.org/support. where you can find even more ways to help keep this show going. Thank you to all of you who are supporting us with your hard-earned money and valuable time. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or even exceed your expectations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Welcome back to part two of our Ghost in the Machine time travel series. Now, this story has a lot of dates and details. I mean, it's a time travel story, so that's not surprising. But one of the first questions is, when did this story begin? Now, much of the story you're about to hear happens in the very early parts of the year 2000, but it also may have begun in 1998 on Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM show. On July 29th, 1998, Art Bell did an open lines evening where he invited only time travelers to call in.
So there you have it, going to open lines in a moment. Once again, though, my timeline, my line for time travelers, bear in mind that you must have arrived here and done your time traveling, not mentally, but through some type of actual machine. A fully instrumented time machine of some sort.
For 3 hours, various folks dialed in to explain why they were traveling through time. And then right around the three-hour mark, Art reads a fax from someone who claimed all the other callers were wrong. And although he doesn't self-identify, many believe this was the first message from a man who later called himself John Teeter, or also Time Travel Zero. Time travel's wacky enough, but if Teeter can be believed, he came back to the year 2000 in a souped-up 1967 Corvette to find an old IBM portable computer and to help save the future from an upcoming Unix clock crisis that was exacerbated by a U.S. Civil War and a limited global nuclear war. But sure, time-traveling Corvettes and 1975 computers will surely fix things right back up. Now, on to part two of our Ghost in the Machine Time Travel Old Computer series.
Monster Talk.
Welcome back to part two.
I'm still reeling from part one.
And if you had a reel to reeling, you could record that program for use later on your BBC Micro.
Yeah. Are they still around? Is it the kind of thing that you can find in antique stores?
Well, you can still find BBC Micros, but more importantly, the BBC, when they were like commissioning this computer to be created, they sent out specs to a whole bunch of different companies. And the company that came out with the strongest candidate, I think there were three, but the one that did this. Is Acorn still around? This is actually a trickier question to answer than I realized. Acorn Computers is out of business, but they have a really big footprint in the field of computer innovation. A company's name may become defunct, yet its technological progeny may thrive and reproduce in their absence for years. Acorn's surely left some important innovation seeds around. One in particular that's not only survived, but chances are you own a device running on that architecture right now. Acorn was critical in the development of what became known as RISC chips. These reduced instruction set computers build structures on the chip that perform frequently used high-cost computational functions so that when you program for a RISC processor, you can use those pre-built functions on the chip instead of coding the logic to run in a sort of general-purpose way. In other words, your code can be shorter, yet have the same functionality as a more complex code because the hardware instructions are there for you without the need to write those functions out in software. RISC was a very big topic of discussion in the late 90s, and Apple partnered with Acorn, which led to an entire line of Macintosh that were powered by RISC chips. When it came time to make mobile phones, the lower power consumption and higher functionality profile of RISC chips made them ideal for that class of device. More frequently heard today is the idea of ARM chips, which presently stands for Advanced RISC Machines, but which originally stood for Acorn RISC Machines. So even though Acorn is defunct as a business, its DNA is still out there, metaphorically speaking, powering devices for a huge portion of the human population.
And that music you just heard was a song called Super Locomotive, which was actually performed on a BBC Micro and arranged by Martin Galway, who went on to become quite famous as a Commodore 64 musician.
Wow, Acorns, Apples.
Yeah, that's right. One of the computers they commissioned, I think, was from Wales, was called the Dragon, which is, you may recall from our coverage of it. Yeah, quite. So that's kind of fun. But yeah, so this time travel story, this next one, is from the very early 2000s. And okay. Art Bell, Coast to Coast AM, he used to do these little segments where he would invite people to call in who, you know, like he would do like an episode where it was Ghost to Ghost AM for Halloween. And it would be only ghost stories. You had to call in with true ghost stories that you had experienced. He would do Area 51 call-ins. If you work at Area 51, you can call in and tell us what's going on, that kind of thing.
Do you think that the callers were legitimate, that they had worked at Area 51?
I would say many of the callers who called in with stories were sincere. Many of the callers who called in with stories were pulling America's legs.
Storytelling.
I know people who called in and told crazy stories, and I've heard people confess to calling in crazy stories.
Yeah, I could imagine that going on.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir. Hi.
My name is Gordon. I'm a theoretical physicist. I work at a research facility.
Are you working? You're a theoretical physicist. Are you working on anything that you can tell us about?
Yes.
You are.
We're working on portal technology.
Now, tell me about that portal technology.
I'm afraid I cannot go into it.
Is the ability to travel?
Yes.
All right. Well, you keep us up to date on this as much as you can. Portal technology.
And when he asks for time travel, what do you think he's going to get?
Well, you know, that's all you're going to get. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he asks for time travel stories and people phone them in. And considering the time, people would also fax them in, which just is just.
Wow. I love it.
When you listen to these old shows, it's like he's talking about fast blast and emails and faxes, and it's faxes that cracks me up. It's like,
I can't believe to this day, though, how many businesses want you to fax things through. And it's just like, who has a fax machine?
Well, regulatory stuff around medical, that they require faxes for things. It kills me. It's like, come on. Well, come on. Yeah. It's like,
keep up. Yeah.
So in addition to Coast AM, Art Bell also had what they called Post to Post AM, the forums section on the webpage, which is hilarious. And I mean, we've talked about Art Bell before. We did a whole episode on that. But
A favorite one.
Yeah. And I love old radio shows like that. And we talked about Long John Nebel and some of the history of UFO radio and that sort of stuff. But with Bell, these time travel stories and these posts on the forum, they were generally, like I say, they're wacky and they're not consistent. But this guy calling himself Time Travel Zero and later called himself John Titor or John Titor. I've heard it said both ways, but T-I-T-O-R. I'm going to say Titor, but I'm spelling it's T-I-T-O-R. John Titor claims that he was from a future where America had a civil war in 2015. I think it starts like in the early 2000s, like 2005, and ends around 2015, and then there's a nuclear war. He's from the future where it's after the nuclear war, and, you know, America sort of disintegrated into a much smaller version of itself, and the world's having a lot of problems. And he's on a special time travel mission to come back and get an IBM 5100 portable computer. Now, it is a sexy machine, I have to admit.
Very special mission.
It is. It, you know, and he posts information about his time travel vehicle, like how it's put together, what it looks like. He posts pictures of it. Part of it looks like it's part of a car. It's got, you know, it's got a seat. Apparently, he has to be inside a vehicle because the time travel equipment is quite heavy. So he can drive around, and he needs to be physically located where his destination is going to be when he time travels. And then the time travel uses a dual micro singularity engine in order to navigate through the multiverse. And then the further away you get, you know.
And in English, that means?
It means he believes that they created two tiny black holes that can be held and used to navigate forward and backwards in time. And so it's all part of this big piece of equipment. And it involves gravity, micro singularities. Like, and it's got limits too. You can only go to like anybody come in. The whole thing that gets him fired up is like people are reporting from beyond 2500 AD. And he says, well, that's not real because everybody knows that if you try to get past like, I think it was like 2536, you can't because nothing's there. Like, it's just a dead space, right?
Everyone knows.
But he's coming back specifically to get this IBM 5100 computer, which is tied to something called the 2038 problem. And that's a real thing. Which has to do
kind of like the
Y2K.
Y2K, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything being Y2K compliant, and I remember that. Yeah.
Right, right. What it is if you have a 8-bit or 16-bit, well, really 16-bit is what we're probably looking at, a computer with running on Unix time. That basically Unix time measures how many seconds have passed since January 1st, 1970. Okay.
Okay.
And 16 bits is how much, how wide the memory register is, if you will.
Okay.
And there's a point where the time, the number of seconds you have to track, is going to be a number that is larger than that 16-bit register. So okay. when that 16 bits gets filled up, it's called an overflow error. And computers behave poorly when they are trying to write to a register and it's full.
Okay, so this is a real problem.
It is a real thing. Now, in the year 2038, that register is going to fill up and overflow. So if you're running a 16-bit machine in 15 years, is that right?
Oh, I don't even want to think about that.
Yeah, as far in the future, in the mysterious future of 15 years from now. And it's plausible there'll still be systems affected. But I imagine as we get closer and closer to 2038, But the easiest solution is switch to a 64-bit architecture because then you suddenly have – you know, billions and billions of seconds to deal with, right? It'll be, you know, thousands of years in the future. I'm probably saying that wrong, but it's a long, 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 long way if right. you can switch to a bigger register. So it's not additive, it's exponential. So going from 60 to 32 and 32 to 64 is massive differences at the exponent level. So.
One of the best things about doing Monster Talk is that when I discover something I didn't know, I can share it with an audience instead of my long-suffering family. As you may have heard me mention, one of my many passions is understanding technological innovation. Because of the rapid developments of computers, they're a bit like fruit flies. Scientists study fruit flies because in their quick generations, you can see patterns of biology emerging that might take hundreds or thousands of years to see in more slow-lived life forms such as large mammals. The field of computing similarly lets you look at rapidly emerging patterns of innovation and economics, all sped up. And I've spent at least a decade studying and researching these patterns. But as Donald Rumsfeld once alluded, it's the unknown unknowns, the things you don't know but aren't aware that you don't know, that sneak up on you. I had a big old hole in my computer history knowledge I didn't even realize until it got laid bare while preparing this episode. At the heart of these two stories of computers and time manipulation are old computers. The BBC Micro we talked about in the first half of this was an 8-bit machine, and because it hails from 1975, I thought that the second machine we'll be talking about, the IBM 5100 Portable, would also be an 8-bit machine. But it wasn't. When we talk about these 8-bit and 16-bit systems, what we're talking about is the width of the data bus, which is to say, if you were to think of each click of a computer cycle. So that's how much data could be manipulated at one time. So since computers deal with numbers, you can think of a full bus as what would be the value if every register were filled with ones. So the difference between an empty register and a full one can be a number represented by decimal values, where the 8-bit, 16-bit, and 32 turn into shockingly large numbers. So here's some quick examples of comparing binary values to decimal. So an 8-bit bus can handle numbers from 0 to 255 at once per clock cycle, right? So a 16-bit bus can handle numbers from 0 to 65,536. As you can see, that number is significantly larger. A 32-bit bus can handle numbers from 0 to 4,294,967,295. And the now ubiquitous 64-bit bus, which you probably are using at home, can handle numbers from 0 to 18,046,744,073,709,551,615. The point is, there's a big difference between these bus sizes, and the amount of processing bandwidth for each new standard is staggeringly exponentially more expansive. And keep in mind that the architecture might not match the operating system. For example, some people install 32-bit operating systems on a 64-bit piece of hardware. And there's sometimes good reasons for that, but that's out of scope for this insert. So, the big realization that I had was that 16-bit and 8-bit architectures, by the mid-1970s, are really more of a design choice than a major innovation. The IBM 5100 that we'll be discussing in this segment has a 16-bit bus, but at the exact same time, the Intel 8080 chip, the one that will become the basis for many early PCs, ends up being an 8-bit chip. Motorola 6800 is an 8-bit chip. Chuck Peddle's MOS 6502, which is really common in old PCs, was an 8-bit chip. And the IBM PC ends up using the 8-bit 8088 chip. But the Intel chip before that, the 8086, had a 16-bit chip design. So what I learned and should have known is that 16-bit buses existed simultaneously, but weren't yet embraced by the industry. As memory and storage capacity increased and prices dropped, 16-bit eventually replaces 8-bit, and then 32 and 64-bit buses become truly required to make modern computing work the way we expect. Anyway, the main thing is my original idea of calling this two-part episode 8-bit Time Travelers, which I loved, became inappropriate when I learned that 16-bit computing existed in the form of a portable computer in 1975. But 8-bit Time Travelers is still a really cool name for a synthwave band, so somebody get on that.
When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online, schedule package pickups through the dashboard, and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
So really not much of a problem.
No. Probably not to the point that you need to time travel back to the 90s.
yeah, but such an interesting theory.
It is, and what happens is Teeter's posting all these things. He's making predictions. He's telling this exciting story about Civil War and how, you know, when he was a teenager, he had to, like, join these military units and fight. He's talking about the, you know, multiverse theory of physics. He's talking about micro black holes. It's interesting stuff. And he tries to be vague enough that is plausible in sci-fi and makes predictions that are scary and hard to falsify, right?
Right. Did he write a book then?
Yes. Well, someone did. again, John Titor is also a pseudonym because, you know, time travel. So.
Yeah, that's right.
But he writes, okay, so spoilers, right? A lot of people were really curious, if, first of all, is he real? Is he serious? Where is he from? You know, who might he be?
The future.
Yeah. So there's a web, I guess a video channel called The Hoax Hunter, a guy named John Houston who does skeptical investigations into this sort of thing. He does a bunch of looking into it. In 2009, he posts a report saying he believes that John Titor is a character created by a guy named Larry Haber, who's a entertainment lawyer. And there's sort of a time travel foundation that's been created, and Houston tracks down all the business
stuff, you know, like, finding out who registered the license, who registered the domains, all that kind of stuff. Here's the thing. This whole story involved not just time travel and sort of this creative narrative about, you know, World War and all these sort of sci-fi adventure tropes, but it also had a bunch of information about technology and computing. And so the question, you know, does it make sense that this lawyer would know enough to do this? But it turns out that his brother is apparently a longtime IT computer scientist type person. So he is like, it could have been collaboration between the two of them or maybe someone else as well.
Did they ever come forward and respond to the accusation?
To my knowledge, they have not. But they also at one point they had registered John Titor as a trademark with the USPTO. And that has been let go. It's abandoned. So if they are behind it, maybe they just didn't get enough money out of it to keep it going. And a lot of stuff's happened since then, right? That was, that was 2009 when he did that uncovering. Another person that may have been involved, and this is, I think, a little bit more interesting, is there's this guy named Joseph Matheny, and he is one of the co-creators of a really, really weird thing that maybe we could talk about on a different episode called Ong's Hat, which is both a place in New Jersey, but it's also a collaborative, fictional, I don't know, ecosystem. There's other things like this, but basically it's kind of a game. It's kind of a website. It's kind of a collection of stories. So a shared world, if you will. And it's quite interesting. And so he seems like a good candidate to have participated. And at one point during, you know, someone, he said at one point on the record, he said, John Titor, quote,
is a story that was created as a literary experiment by people who were observing what I was doing with Ong's Hat, and these people wanted something like that. So I was a consultant on the project, but it wasn't my project.
Okay.
That sounds extraordinarily plausible to me.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, this is, just gets more and more in-depth and involved.
It does. And then at some point, John Titor says that he's going back and won't be staying. You know, he leaves some sort of clues about what the future holds. And, you know, I find this kind of well-meaning. His departing advice is not like, here's what's going to happen in the future, because, you know, he's going off to try to fix things. So maybe things will change.
That's right. Good point.
When Titor was posting in the year 2000, he sent out a list of 10 pieces of advice for people who want to prepare for the future. It's interesting to note that the advice he gives, some of it's timeless and some of it seems very specifically focused around news issues of the time, like mad cow disease and HIV/AIDS. Here's his list of 10 pieces of advice for those who want to prepare for the future. Number one, do not eat or use products from any animal that is fed and eats parts from its own dead. Number two, do not kiss or have intimate relations with anyone you don't know. Number three, learn basic sanitation and water purification. Number four, be comfortable around firearms. Learn to shoot and clean a gun. Number five, get a good first aid kit and learn to use it. Number six, find five people within 100 miles that you trust with your life and stay in contact with them. Number seven, get a copy of the U.S. Constitution and read it. Number eight, eat less. Number nine, get a bicycle and two sets of spare tires. Ride it at least 10 miles a week. And number 10, consider what you would bring with you if you had to leave your home in 10 minutes and never return. So a lot of that's classic advice for, you know, have a bug out kit in case there's an emergency. Those are fairly good pieces of advice. Number one and number two specifically seem like they're pulled from the headlines of the year 2000.
Yeah, it all sounds like advice. Some of it, the kind of stuff you're told to do in California in case there's a massive earthquake or that kind of survivor man mentality as well.
Exactly. Mm. And it's well-written stuff. I mean, it's internet forum stuff, but it's in its early 2000s, but it's still, it's well put together. And it exists in this ecosystem of Art Bell forum posts, which is just full of other interesting things. If you, I don't believe any of it, but I think it's fun to read. What
he was a caller to the show.
No, he was not. I don't think, or at least I was never able to find it, but it was so popular, Art would read some of the stuff online. In fact, we can put a clip in here of Art actually reading one of these John Titor faxes, which I think is really interesting.
Well, all right. That's it. We will continue to take time calls, time traveler calls tonight. Dear Art, I had to fax when I heard other time travelers calling in from any time past the year 2500 AD. Please let me explain. Time travel was invented in 2034. Offshoots of certain successful fusion reactor research allowed scientists at CERN to produce the world's first contained singularity engine. The basic design involves rotating singularities inside a magnetic field. By altering the speed and direction of rotation, you can travel both forward and backward in time. Time itself can be understood in terms of connected lines. When you go back in time, you travel on your original timeline. When you turn the singularity engine off, a new timeline is created due to the fact that you and your time machine are now there. In other words, a new universe is created. To get back to your original line, you must travel a split second farther back and immediately throw the engine into forward without turning it off. Some interesting outcomes of this are: 1. You meet yourself. I have done it often, even taken a younger version of myself along for a few rides before returning myself to the new timeline and going back to mine. 2. You can alter history in the new universe that you have just created. Most of the time, the changes are subtle. Sometimes I'll notice car models that don't exist or books that come out late. The oldest one was a skyscraper that wasn't built in a near-favorite store of mine in New York. Interestingly, when you travel in time, you must compensate for the orbit of the Earth. Since the time machine doesn't move, you have to adjust the engine so you remain on the planet when you turn it off. Unfortunately, it was also discovered that anyone going forward in time from my 2036 hit a brick wall in the year 2564. Everyone who has ever been there has reported that nothing exists. When the machine is turned off, you find yourself surrounded by blackness and silence. Now, most time travelers are trying to find out where the line went bad by going into the past, creating a new universe, and proceeding forward to see if the same thing results in 2564. It appears the line went bad around the year 2000. I'm here now, in this time, to test a few theories of mine before going forward. Now, for the future, you might want to know about: 1. Y2K is a disaster. Many people die on the highways when they freeze to death trying to get to warmer weather. 2. The government tries to keep power by instituting martial law, but all of it collapses when their efforts to bring the power back up fail. 3. A power facility in Denver is able to restart itself, but is mobbed by hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed. This convinces most that maybe we shouldn't bring the old system back up. 4. A few years later, communal government system is developed after the Constitution takes a few twists. China retakes Taiwan. Israel wins the largest battle for their life, and Russia is covered in nuclear snow from their collapsed reactors. Art, the reason I'm here now is because I believe a nuclear weapon set off by Iraq in the Middle East war with Israel might have something to do with the damaged timeline. I will test that theory and get back to you. Please pray that we discover the reason why there is no apparent future after 2564. So I couldn't resist. I thought that was quite a good fax. There you have it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Cool. And I wonder why he was never invited on the show, or if they couldn't track him down, or...
Well, I mean, that's a really good question, and I probably should know the answer. If I can find the answer, I'll put an insert here. My guess would be, though, he's probably avoiding getting his voice on recording.
To be identified, because, sure.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be identified by anything. And I believe that that is both a good, like that's a perfectly good justification if you're trying to protect a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a perfectly good justification if you're trying to save the timeline and don't want someone to go kill your mother before you're born, that kind of thing.
Either way, yeah. Back to the future.
So,
either way, that works. It is so bizarre. Again, another amazing and strange story.
Yeah. You know, I should check on one thing before we go. Hold on just a second. And that is the I forgot to pull up the specs for the IBM 5100, BM 5100. It was a portable computer, which it was luggable, and 16K of RAM. That's not bad, honestly. It was 1.9 megahertz, 16K of RAM, and it had a 5-inch CRT.
So powerful for its time.
It was that. Here's the catch. It's a portable computer from 1975.
Wow. So older than me.
Yeah, and it cost a lot. Like, it cost, like, a bare bones model was $9,000, and a fully loaded one was like $20,000 in 1975.
People really
needed to play Zork. I don't know. It's like, I have to have Eliza, and I have to have it now. I don't know. It's
and some serious money. Wow. I mean, okay. Yeah, I would imagine it would just be businesses, and I mean, how much are these things worth now?
You know what? It might be valuable historically, but I doubt it's worth $20,000. I don't know. I mean, John Titor, remember?
Put into it.
John Titor, they probably spent millions to get him back in time to pick up a copy. Now, I tell you one thing that I find interesting. They say in the specs, they said it was based on a 16-bit processor called the Palm, which was a program all logic and microcode. It's astonishing to me that there was a 16-bit processor in a portable computer in 1975. That sounds like time travel itself, honestly.
That's pretty impressive.
But, you know, much like the Alto, which was the first graphical computer produced by Xerox, they were beautiful machines, and they would have been comparable to what we would see on a Macintosh by, like, 1986. Mm-hmm. But they're being produced in the early 1970s, but they cost, like, $10,000 a piece.
Wow.
You know, so, yeah, it's $10,000 in, you know, 1975. I mean, hello.
Way to today.
So, wow. So it's a bit pricey, but
totally. But it must have been worth it to some people to buy. I mean, there must have been a market.
Yeah. There must have been a reason for them, and I don't know how many they ever sold, but it supported the ability to run APL, mm-hmm. which is an IBM mainframe language, and if you're going to say your time traveler is coming back for a rare computer that's special somehow, I believe that one of the things that did it had dual modes, and one of the modes, I think some of the sort of justification for why it might have been useful was about this idea that it could have been used to debug programs in the future that were actually tied to the past.
Oh, I see.
So you need an old thing to work, what have we learned? If we've learned nothing from Turing, I mean, we should at least learn that any machine that's Turing complete is also capable of being emulated on a more powerful machine, which is why you can, even though 8-bit computers and some of these 16-bit things may not be available right now, they can all be emulated on more modern machines. That's why you can still play 8-bit games, and you can still play 16-bit games. You can still play 32-bit games, even if you're using a 64-bit computer. So emulation suggests that this would not have been necessary to spend billions of dollars on a time traveler to get this machine.
Yeah. That would ruin a good story.
It's hard to falsify. Right. Yeah, it would. I mean, I think maybe some of the best evidence that we don't have time travel is that nobody attended Stephen Hawking's time traveler party. Have you heard about this?
I haven't.
There's a famous photo of Stephen Hawking sitting in a room with balloons and everybody around it, but there's no people but Stephen Hawking. He threw a time traveler party and then did not send out the invites until after the party was over. That way people could come back and go to the party.
So, right. And I have updated photos.
Right, but nobody showed up. That's too bad.
Well, now, are you going to, for this episode, to read out some of those predictions as well? Because you've got these lists down here.
That's a great idea. I'll insert some of his predictions. Some of them came true, some of them didn't, and I think we should comment on that. So the first, he claimed CERN would create miniature black holes in 2001. That's one of his predictions.
Okay, so that didn't happen.
To the best of our knowledge, did not happen, although when they were going to flip that machine on, a lot of people went nuts saying that they were going to destroy the world. I don't think any of the scientists really thought that was plausible at all, but it was on numerous, blogs, radio shows, television shows, worried about what would happen. And, people are always afraid of big technology. So,
This kind of reminds me of psychic predictions for the forthcoming year, and then to go back and reflect on those and see what did happen and what didn't happen.
Exactly. And of course, the big one, I guess, was he said there was going to be a civil war in 2005, and then that didn't happen until 2016. So
that's exactly what I was thinking. So he was a couple of years out. Maybe when he went back in time, he threw out the timeline or something.
It's like Terminator 2, where they don't stop it. They just shift it a little bit.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, his last post was March 24th, 2001. But again, the main thing, though, there is, he signed off and then effectively was never heard from again, except through the book, John Titor, Time Traveler. There was a documentary a few years later. And, of course, that sudden interest in the IBM 5100, which I think just sort of spiked and disappeared. Those old computers are still worth keeping running, and I certainly do my share over here at my house. And
yeah, thank you. Thank you for your service.
Yeah. Anyway, that's the John Titor story in a nutshell. Is there anything to it? Is it plausible? No.
but it is another ripping yarn.
It is another ripping yarn. I saw nothing in the story that seemed worth believing in. I mean, the predictions were vague enough, they could have, but wherever there was dates and certitude, reality has not comported with those.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's really interesting that this, the hoax hunter had gone and done this research and has pointed the finger at this lawyer and his brother, a computer scientist. They sound like a likely pair.
I don't know if they're still, it seems like they would not be able to still be making money from it, except maybe from the books. And I don't know if that's for a corporate, I didn't check to see if that book had an author who is a human or an author who is a corporation. And that matters,
I just don't know how much you could make from this. It sounds like it was really popular in the day, but I don't know if it would have been much of a moneymaker.
Exactly. And these things tend to like go in cycles, but a lot of these are like flash in the pan. There's a minute when everybody's talking, and if you can cash, great. But if you can't, you're too bad. Like, yeah. I'm really surprised Ken Webster was able to get another reprint out, but I'm glad he did, because the paperback had gotten to be like $500, which is a little not nobody was paying $500
like
bucks for it.
Like an academic book.
Well, algorithms had driven the price up because it was rare, and now with the reprint, that it's back down into the quite reasonable price.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been some interest in it, and same for this book as well, for John Titor.
Exactly. Well, I'm a little mad right now that the IBM 5100 is causing me to have to retitle this show. But anyway, I thought these are two interesting stories, and if you think about it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm so glad that you've done all of this research. Really appreciate you exploring this, because I just wasn't aware of these stories, and I wonder how many of our readers are familiar with these tales.
Yeah, and we'll put links. I mean, if you want to read more, obviously there's thousands and thousands of pages that can be read. If you go back to the old forums, and if you go to these books and watch, you can watch documentaries about these things. And they're fun. I mean, they are. I think they're relatively harmless.
Yeah. But I'm still, not surprised that you've said some people believe in this still.
They absolutely do. There are some very fervent believers in all of this stuff. But you know what? The world's a big old place, and if you want to use critical thinking and logic and reason and science and evidence, these stories fall flat.
They don't hold up. Yeah,
but
it's still a fun tale.
They are a fun tale, and if you just like crazy stories, these stories are wild rides. They are wild rides.
Fit that profile. Yeah. really cool to hear about these, and look forward to getting some feedback from our listeners too.
Yeah, but the main thing is, for our listeners again, old computers don't give you time travel. They don't give you ghosts. Just hold on to them, take care of them. They won't last forever, but keep them going while you can. That's that may not be the message I'm supposed to be giving.
Too much money in the future, but
this is just how I'm justifying all my old computer equipment.
Yeah, you don't need to.
But in all seriousness, I think these are interesting stories, and I remember both of them when they were sort of at their peak, you know, in the public. And so they're still fond memories, but I have enjoyed like looking into them and sort of seeing it. You know, when I first heard them, I was more gullible and younger. But the first one, especially the BBC Micro story, always seemed like a fun time travel ghost story. And that's an interesting mix.
Yeah. Technology and ghost lore. It's a strange combination.
Old houses and linguistics and bookies.
Yeah.
And
so. Yeah.
And then people from the future and consciousness and traveling and so many things. So,
someone's got a great imagination.
They really do. Anyway, we'll be back again in another week with more Monster Talk. So thanks for listening.
As always. Thanks, Blake, all right, for all of your hard work.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard a discussion about the self-proclaimed time travel soldier known as John Titor, who says he came back from the 2030s to save us from a dark future where our computer clocks might stop working. I still like the story, but if a time traveler came back to the year 2000 from the 2030s, it seems like a mention of, 9/11, COVID, global climate change, or any number of massively useful details from the future might have been better than what we actually get. But then again, I'm skeptical and I don't get to have fun like the other kids. I'm kidding. Of course, we have lots of fun putting this show together. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. And as you cruise through the time stream in your 60s muscle car, you can listen to almost anything, but you picked Monster Talk. And for that, we thank you.
Been a Monster House presentation.
When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.